Session number 10478, Reel 1.
Commodore dear, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, Air Commodore, whereabouts you were born and about your family background?
Yes, I was born in Auckland, in New Zealand, in 1917. My father was a civil servant.
And what was your education?
I was educated up to matriculation, as it then was standard, at the Whanganui High School.
Which high school?
Whanganui High School. I joined, I did a year articled to a solicitor, and then I joined the Royal Air Force. And I was accepted, I think it was, in April 1937.
What made you decide to go in for flying?
Well, I was always very keen on flying, and there was no opportunity in those days to fly in New Zealand, even if I could have afforded it privately. And in 1937, the British government opened the direct commissioning to the then Dominions, South Africa, Australia, Canada and New Zealand, and invited applications from young men, and in age bracket of 18 to 25, I think it was, provided you had the educational qualification of matriculation.
Was it easy for you to get in?
Well, I applied, and they sent out from England a selection board which covered both Australia and New Zealand, and we went before this board and had a medical and then waited to hear, and I was one of the lucky first 24 selected in New Zealand, this was.
At that stage, in 1937, had you anticipated that a war was on the horizon?
No, never. It never occurred to me. I just wanted to fly.
What? How did you cope with the flying training? Did it come easy to you?
Well, I did. You know, I was eventually classified as above average. I had my ups and downs, but it went fairly straightforward, really.
And when war was actually declared, did you actually hear Chamberlain's famous broadcast on the 3rd of September that we were at war with Germany?
Yes, I did. I was at Hornchurch in Essex in a Spitfire squadron by that time.
Were you all in the mess listening to the radio?
Yes, I think if my memory serves me right, we gathered around the radio to hear the announcement, yes.
And how did you all react?
Well, let's get at them. You know, we were quite keen, being young and thinking, oh, well. But it didn't take long before we realised it wasn't as much fun as we thought it might be by the time Dunkirk and the Battle of Britain came along.
Do you think in those days, in September 1939, that you underestimated the Luftwaffe?
I don't think we underestimate them. The fact is, we didn't know much about them. I mean, we knew they were good. We knew they'd had war experience in Spain, but that's where it is. And we knew they had in the Messerschmitt a damn good aircraft, but we reckoned the Spitfire was as good.
When did you first come into contact with the Spitfire?
With the Spitfire itself?
Yes.
Well, I was on 54 Squadron, which I think I'm right in saying was the third squadron in the Royal Air Force converted to Spitfires. We had Gladiators 54, and that was it would have been in about April 39 of that sort of order.
What impact did the Spitfire make on you when you first saw it and flew it?
Marvellous. Couldn't believe it was, you know, because we were on Gladiators, which were biplanes, as you perhaps know, and they were no aircraft to go to war in.
But one hears that people felt a certain affection for the biplanes because of their manoeuvrability.
Oh, yes, you had an affection for them, but you realised that in terms of the fighting the German Air Force, who had it, 109s, you wouldn't have stood a chance.
What was it actually like flying the Spitfire Mark 1?
Oh, it's super. I mean, it was we hadn't any experience on monoplanes, of course, and there was no such a thing as a dual aircraft in those days. So you just learnt the cockpit drill and the pilot's handbook you read carefully and you flew it, and right from the word go, it felt right as an aircraft. Felt right.
You didn't find it a fragile aircraft?
No. It was amazingly tough. I mean, it looked fragile, a narrow undercarriage. Crosswind landings were, to start with, you had to get used to that, but it was amazingly tough aircraft, really, as it was to prove later on, of course.
Did it have any vices at all?
Nice, narrow undercarriage and a crosswind, if you can call it a vice, but as soon as you got used to it, you could fly it quite easy. No, it didn't really have any vices.
Did you make any personal adaptions or additions to your particular Spitfire? Anything in the way of mirrors to look backwards? Or
No. We didn't have rear mirrors to start. No additions at all. You wouldn't have been allowed to put anything on, other than a logo. You wouldn't have been allowed to put anything on the thing.
Did you put a logo on?
Yes, I had a kiwi, which, as you know, is the New Zealand bird which doesn't fly.
And so each of the pilots put their own symbol on, did they?
No, some did and some didn't. I was a flight commander, you see, when the Battle of Britain started. I was a flight commander.
Sometimes we see film with people putting kills on the aeroplanes in the form of swastikas, yes, or something, yes, like that. Did, yes, you ever do that?
No, I never believed in that.
Why not?
I just thought it was a bit of boasting. I didn't like the idea of that at all. Very few people did, you know. I know there were some, but very few people did.
Did you find that your brother officers and pilots showed any signs of superstition during the war?
No.
They didn't have lucky charms or anything of that kind of thing?
Well, there may have been the odd one that carried a lucky charm, but he didn't boast about it, or one didn't know. I certainly didn't carry one.
Can you tell me what your duties in the early part of the war consisted of?
Well, I was at Hornchurch, as I say, and we were, our prime responsibility was for the defence of London, or approaches to London, but up till the time that Dunkirk started, which the first real cut, we just did patrols in the Channel, convoy patrols, escorting convoys up the Channel. And we had a certain state of readiness to keep on the ground.
You weren't involved in something called the Battle of Barking Creek,
yes,
are you?
Yes, indeed I was.
Can you tell me what you remember about that?
Well, all I remember about it is that we were at readiness and we were scrambled to what we were told to intercept an X-raid. An X-raid was the terminology given in the plotting room to unidentified aircraft, and they called it an X-raid. And we vectored all around our sector by the controller, and then in the event didn't see anything, and guns were firing and people were going around in circles, and we came back, and it wasn't until we got on the ground we learned that a Spitfire squadron and a Hurricane Spitfire squadron, which was 74 squadron at Hornchurch where I was based, mistook some Hurricanes from North Wheel, which was a neighbouring fighter station, thought they were 109s. It seems incredible that they would have done so, but one's got to remember, you're all keyed up and you didn't think about the very fact that a 109 could never have got as far as England from then borders of Germany.
So you didn't actually see any shooting?
I didn't. Well, I saw guns being... We were shot at by the ACK, but I didn't see any air shooting, no.
Was there much rivalry between one squadron and another?
Not rivalry. Friendly competition is a better way of putting it. Not rivalry as such, no.
Some people say that there was rivalry between Hurricane pilots and Spitfire
pilots. No. I mean, if you're on Hurricanes, they were the best. If you're on Spitfires, they were the best. There was no rivalry, no.
Can we go on to the battle for France in 1914? Can you tell me what part you took in that?
Well, we were... when the British Army started retreating and Dunkirk was going to be the point of evacuation, we, fighter squadrons in East Anglia, and as I said, I was at Horn Church, were sent out on patrol to cover the beachhead, you know, the evacuation area up and down that coast. And we did two or three trips a day. And it seemed... it's the first time we'd, as fighter pilots, we'd cross the channel to stay over there to make combat and then come back, because the endurance factor on a Spitfire, before this they had no drop tanks in those days, was fairly critical, and you couldn't stay all that long, and we weren't accustomed to finding our way back, so to speak, across the channel. And so we patrolled the coast from Boulogne, really, up to Dunkirk and up as far as Antwerp, trying to support from the air the evacuation of the British Army. And of course we got in combat with the Germans. By that time had moved some of their bases forward, and they were able to get their fighters as far as the bridgehead. And so we came into contact with Dorniers, Heinkels, Messerschmitts, and Messerschmitt 110s.
Do you have any specific memories of any of the dogfights at that time?
Yes, I have a very specific memory, because I think it's recorded history that I was the first Spitfire pilot to have combat with a 109. And that was over Dunkirk, Calais Marc, which was an airfield on the outskirts of Dunkirk. And we were patrolling over there, and some 109s appeared, and there were two of us actually at the time, and we got into combat with them, and I got on the tail of 109 and managed to, you know, to shoot him down. And I think it's the first recorded combat between a 109 and a Spitfire. Forgotten the date now, somewhere in last week in May.
Did you see what happened to him?
Yes, he went down into the into the sea on the edge of the on the coastline.
Did he bail out?
No, he was too low. This was all at about 500 feet.
Did you have any successes against the German bombers or dive bombers?
Yes, I a Dornier and a Heinkel. In fact, at Dunkirk, I regret to say, I was shot down by the rear gunner of a Dornier. which eventually came down itself.
Can you describe how that happened?
Well, I mean, this Dornier appeared, it was fairly cloudy, and I had my flight out of the clouds over the bridgehead, and we chased him, and I got onto his tail and was firing a burst at him, and suddenly I could see return fire from the rear gunner, and suddenly I felt a juddering sort of thing, and I think it was probably fairly lucky, and a bullet from the rear gunner went into my glycol tank, and that's my coolant system gone. That meant I was out of combat. I had to come down, and I crash landed on the beach between Dunkirk and Ostend, actually. And the Dornier came down over the top of me, smoking, and glided away inland. I think he must have landed somewhere further inland.
Were you injured?
Well, I wasn't injured until I landed, and I hit my head on the front of the cockpit and cut my thing that knocked me out momentarily. But
Cut your eyebrow?
Well, I've still got to, you know, cut a gash in my eyebrow. I went forward onto the front of the Spitfire, onto the windscreen.
And was the plane a write-off?
Well, it was. I landed wheels up, of course, and to make certain it was. I landed right on the edge of the water, and the tide happened to be coming in. And I, when I came to, I was only out, I imagine, I don't know, for not very long. I scrambled out of the thing and got my parachute out and walked up the beach towards a cafe I saw on the beach. And by that tide, the tide was gradually coming over the Spitfire anyhow. And it was never recovered, so I imagine it sunk into the sand in the course of time and further and further.
And then what happened to you then?
Well, then I had this bad cut in my eye, and there were in the small cafe on the coast, a woman said, you know, I was bleeding rather badly, and she stuck it together with plaster and things and put a bandage around it. And then I knew they were evacuating from Dunkirk because that was part of our job, so I set off to get to Dunkirk. I expect it took me 2 or 3 hours because there was a lot of refugee traffic, and eventually I collared a bicycle which I saw and got onto that and rode. I was originally going to go to Ostend, but I found that because I was as near to Ostend as I was Dunkirk, but I met a couple of British Army Tommies inland a bit, and I said, where are you going? And they said, you tell us. And I said, well, you're evacuating, aren't they? They said, we don't know, we're just what left of our thing. So I said, where are you going? And they said, well, we're staying here till we meet up with some of our particular company, but we're going to eventually get to Dunkirk. So I thought, well, I better go to Dunkirk. And that's where I went, and I got onto the beach eventually at Dunkirk with all the soldiers.
What was it like there?
Pretty hectic.
Because of the bombing?
Well, the strafing and the bombing, and you know, and the we were on the beach taking cover sort of stuff. Then I eventually got onto a destroyer, in fact, and which was bombed on the way back, but we didn't get hit.
What was the organisation for getting you from the beach onto the destroyer?
Well, there was an organisation run by the army, and you got into a line sort of style, you know. And up at the time I got out, they were still able to get alongside the jetty at Dunkirk, and the destroyer had come in, and I managed to get on it. But there were other people swimming out to the boats and things. Anyhow, we came back to Dover, and that was it, and I was back again.
Do you know what dates that you left Dunkirk?
I would think the 31st of May or the 1st of June.
And do you know the name of the destroyer?
Montrose, I think it was.
Montrose?
I think it was.
What were conditions like aboard?
Oh, we were crowded with soldiers, you know, absolutely. Stuffed to the gills it was, and we were bombed. It was weaving. We were bombed. Not far out after pulling off, we weren't hit. Cloud fortune was fairly low, so, and we pulled into Dover eventually.
Whilst you were at Dunkirk, did any of the soldiers make any remarks about you being RAF?
Yes, they did. They were very anti. They said, where the hell had we been? And I, who'd been flying 10 days non-stop up to the time I was shot down, 2 and 3 sorties a day, and I was pretty tired. This was early in the morning this happened. I sort of answered in no mean manner and said, we were there, but you perhaps didn't see us. And I told them, no, but where's the RAF? They, you know, they weren't very pleased with me. I was the only airman on board, of course.
Were they good-humoured or unpleasant about it?
Well, a bit unpleasant, but one couldn't blame them, really. They were pretty worn out, you know.
Whilst you were in combat over Dunkirk, what kind of tactics were you told to use about tackling enemy planes?
Well, really, we had attack patterns which we had practiced. But we soon learned, against fighters anyhow, that they went by the board. You really saw enemy aircraft, and the leader, whoever he may be, said, you know, we're going to attack him from above or behind. And each chap went on in on his own, really. The tactics which we practiced were strictly evolved thinking that you'd be attacking unescorted bombers, and therefore you could line up and all do all these sort of things. Well, we were never able to do that.
What did you think of the calibre of the Luftwaffe air crew over France?
Oh, well, I, as I say, had the first combat of 109, and I put in a lengthy report about it when I got back, because I was able to stay behind this chap for a long time. He tried to shake me off. And I put in a report to the effect that, except initially in the dive, the Spitfire was superior. And, of course, that was pooh-hooed at the time, I don't mind telling you, by those at the top. But in the event, I was proved right. They were always better in the dive than we were, because they were... Spitfire wasn't a good diving aircraft. It had a... The wing wasn't suited to fire. I mean, you could dive, but you know, 109 had a less air resistance and it could dive. Conversely, the Spitfire could climb much better and it could turn better.
So your superiors poo-hooed the idea.
Well, they looked at on as sort of, you know, he's a young chap, and all our records show that the 109's better than the Spitfire. And I said, well, in close combat it wasn't. That's all there was to it.
From the height that you were at over Dunkirk, what did the beaches look like?
Oh, it was... Well, Dunkirk itself was on fire. I think there must have been an oil store, because it was an oil storage place, wasn't it? Tank, and it was just completely overcast by black smoke. And that mingled with... There was, most of the time, there was lowish cloud. And so you, for miles away, you knew where Dunkirk was. It was just black smoke over the town and the cloud. And when I got into Dunkirk eventually, of course, it was absolute shambles. The whole town. And the roads leading to it were pretty... bit of a shambles.
What did the beaches look like from the air?
Well, you didn't really see too much of the beaches, because if the cloud allowed it, you stayed a bit higher in order to... And if you were below cloud, you only caught glimpses of them, you know, because you weren't stuck specifically over Dunkirk itself. We used to patrol north and south of it.
When you first saw what the situation was at Dunkirk, were you shocked at the setback that the army had had?
I was when I met these two soldiers in this cafe. I was shocked to find that there didn't seem to be any plan of them retreating, because we had been told, and we'd heard on the radio and read in the papers, they were retreating according to plan. Well, these two Tommies made it quite clear, so far as they were concerned, there was no plan. I think it became a bit chaotic towards the end. I suspect they did have a plan, but when the floodgates opened, the Germans coming through in the north there, well, that was it. They were getting out as fast as they could.
Can you tell me something about 54 Squadron, what it was like to serve with?
Well, it was my first squadron, and after training I went to 54 Squadron. We were equipped with Gladiators at the time. And our first piece of excitement was, of course, the Munich crisis, when we were all brought up to a state of readiness, and we had lovely silver Gladiators with our squadron crest on, and we spent days with buckets of painting all the silver off and camouflaging them and ready to go to the war. And of course we had that year's respite, as you know. And I personally believe, and always believe, that saved us. Because we could have never coped with the Germans and Gladiators, as was proven in Norway, when the Gladiator squadrons were sent to Norway. But at the time, we thought, oh, well, we'll be able to take these chaps on. We had very good morale in the squadrons. We were very proud of our squadrons. And we were a mixed bunch of chaps who had, were all pretty young. I suppose our average age is 21 or something like that. What was I? What were 30? I was 21, you see. And some were younger and some a bit older, about 21, the average age. And we were very keen on flying, and we thought we were good. And the fact that we had gladiators, it didn't occur to us that we'd be shot out of the sky. But we were pleased when we eventually got Spitfires and the bubble burst.
What kind of duties did you take up once you got back from Dunkirk?
I came straight back to my squadron, which had moved from Hornchurch, where we were based, up to Catterick in Yorkshire, for re-equipping and rest, because we'd lost my squadron at Dunkirk. We started with 17 pilots, I think. And I think we finished up with eight of us. Some were taken, shot down and didn't come back, and some were badly injured, but we lost both our flight commanders, and we were, in fact, our casualties for the amount of flying we did and in the time span were greater at Dunkirk than the Battle of Britain. We were operating so far from home, you see, and if you were like me, I was shot down, but I managed to get back. Others didn't.
But you didn't go back to France after you went
across on the boat. No, we moved up to Canada. And of course, Dunkirk finished, I think it finished in the first week in May, June, didn't it?
Yes.
And then we re-equipped at Catterick, and the 41 squadron, which came down to relieve us, when we were re-equipped and ready, we came back to Hornchurch, and they went back to Catterick. And we came back to Hornchurch, re-equipped, replacements for Spitfires and some new pilots, and took up, shall we say, positions for the Battle of Britain, which was about to arrive.
Were the Spitfires you were re-equipped with just the same as...
Yes, 1As we had, they were the same, yes.
Let's go on to the Battle of Britain now, and can you tell me what you remember about how it started? Did you just drift into it?
Well, it was a gradual build-up. The first thing that happened, really, was I think the official dates of the Battle of Britain are put between somewhere in July and somewhere ending in October, something like that. But in June, we were doing convoy patrols again, because at that time the Germans had occupied the Channel coast, and the convoys had to be protected going up the Channel, and we spent most of our time doing convoy patrols and getting odd engagements. I had an engagement with a Dornier, for example. My flight, we managed to shoot it down.